Welcome back to the Feminist Book Club podcast, a show for dangerous, well-read women. Each week, we explore literature and media through a feminist lens as one small way to reclaim our time, our books, and our stories. Let's get started. Happy Thursday, everyone! Renee Powers here, coming at you from the Feminist Book Club headquarters in beautiful Minneapolis, Minnesota. Today's episode is full of incredible information and some pretty good belly laughs. We're chatting with Dr. Jen Gunter, who's the author of the brand new book, The Vagina Bible, The Vulva and the Vagina, Separating the Myth from the Medicine. We chat about the book, the importance of good information, and how to find it online. Bodies in transition, all kinds of transitions, the clitoris, of course, and how Dr. Gunter became Twitter's resident OBGYN, and so much more. We're also giving away a copy of her book, so be sure you head to the show notes to enter to win, or you can also find all the details on how to win on our Instagram account, which is Feminist Book Club Box. There's a double B in there. Don't let that trip you up. Give us a follow while you're there. We share all the details on our subscription boxes, including sneak peeks and full box reveals. And this is actually the last day, speaking of boxes, to get your September box, featuring our partnership with Kristen and Caroline from the podcast Unladylike. So if you haven't signed up for your box yet, do not delay. Use code podcast at feministbookclub.com/shop for a sweet little discount too. All right, now let's move on to today's interview. Welcome back, everyone. Today, I'm sitting down with Dr. Jen Gunter. Dr. Gunter is an obstetrician and gynecologist with nearly three decades of experience as a vulvar and vaginal disease expert. She writes two regular columns for the New York Times called The Cycle and You Asked, and has written for a broad range of outlets, including USA Today, Cosmopolitan, Self, The Cut, and many more. An Elle magazine woman to watch, Dr. Jen is the star of the upcoming CBC series called Jensplaining. Welcome, Jen.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Do you prefer Dr. Gunter, Dr. Jen, or just Jen?
Just Jen is totally
okay.
Fine.
So the first question I ask everyone is, what is your definition of feminism?
Well, I think my definition of feminism is really equality for everybody across the board. And really, that's what I'm sticking to. Just everybody being able to have the same options, the same opportunities, and being able to advance that agenda.
Yeah. So tell me about your new book. It's recently out as of time of recording. It's not out quite yet, but we're releasing this the week that it hits the newsstands. So The Vagina Bible is the title, The Vulva and the Vagina, Separating the Myth from the Medicine. Tell us about that.
Well, you know, I've been writing a lot about the misinformation online that we see with women's health, especially with vagina myths, right? You know, that seems to be, you put vagina in a headline and then all of a sudden it's everywhere. And I got to the point where I thought, okay, I'm writing for so many different outlets about this. I'm writing on my blog, and it just seems to me that women are still asking the same questions, meaning that they're not getting the answers they need online. And I think I'd had a day where I'd seen like three or four women in a row where I'd said, you shouldn't put yogurt in your vagina, you shouldn't put garlic in your vagina. And women come to do this not just because they have randomly think to put food matter in their vagina. Someone online, someone who's presented themselves as an authority, had suggested it. And so three times in a row, I'd heard, how did I not know this? And I thought, God damn it, I need to write a textbook for women. And so that's how I got here.
Yes. So as someone who bought her first copy of Our Bodies, Ourselves in college, How is this different? I've read it, so I know, but I want to share from our traditional textbooks that we would have.
Well, I think Our Bodies, Ourselves came from a very different time when there were almost very few women in medicine. Almost nothing that I've written about in the book has been studied. And actually, a lot of the myths that women come up with online actually come from our bodies ourselves. I mean, they recommend vaginal garlic and vaginal yogurt, right? Which, you know, maybe in the 1970s when there was no other information, that was okay, but we're not there now. So I think that that was definitely a time and place and served a really wonderful purpose because medicine wasn't filling that need. I mean, that's the fault of medicine. But now I'm trying to sort of stand up and say, hey, medicine has done a lot better for us all. And this is the information I'd like you to have.
So why did you choose to call it the Vagina Bible and not the Vulva Bible?
Well, I really wanted to call it the Vagina and Vulva Bible, but I was told that it would just get shortened to the Vagina Bible, that everybody would drop the vulva, which is of course like, you know, a sad reflection of society. And so, but I compromised and I got vulva on, you know, as a subtitle, and I'm fine with that. I think that, you know, something has to speak to people for them, you know, titles that are five lines long are hard. And also, you know, the vagina is, that's also an homage to sort of how we speak about women's bodies now. In a way, it's really become about the vagina, and we mean that for a large part of the reproductive tract. And, you know, as I mentioned in the introduction, I mean, there's a journal called Gut for the gastrointestinal tract. And like, gut is the most imprecise term, but, you know, it works. So.
Right. It's not the clinical term, but it's what we refer to. So it's, yeah, I completely agree. I thought it was really, I really liked that introduction because it speaks to how language evolves, and it may not be the technical term for the outside of our genitalia, but that's the word that we've adopted to refer to our, you know, female genitalia. So I just stumbled over female and male genitalia because I love, this is on the back. I don't know if it's on the back of your final copy, but it's on the back of the advanced review copy. But you also have a chapter about the vagina in transition. And mm-hmm. I love this. I think this is so current and so necessary. This isn't about a book just for women or just for people with vaginas right now. It's also for people with vulvas and vaginas and different genitalia in the future. Can you talk a little bit about trans men and women and how your book addresses that?
Yeah, I really wanted to include that for a whole variety of reasons. I mean, one, you never know who is reading your book. And two, you want to be inclusive. I mean, there are people who have vaginas who are not women. There is also, you know, women who don't have vaginas. So I think it's super important to be very inclusive and even if you're not someone who's in transition now, you never know where you may be in the future. Or if you have a friend or a child that's, you know, that is going through transition or thinking about transition, I wanted to make sure that, you know, the more quality information is out there, the more it just helps everybody. Mm-hmm. And that's why I really wanted that chapter up front, because I wanted to sort of really explain all the different ways you can have a vagina and vulva and all the different ways that that might matter medically to you. So you can have the information and put it in perspective for you, because we should be able to talk about this up front because it's medical care and it's the right thing to do.
Yes. I love that there is so much focus on the care of the person. I feel that a lot of times, especially in the US, and I know you're based in Canada.
Actually, I'm based in the States.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were Canadian.
I am Canadian. I'm both.
Oh. So you have a front row seat to the American medical snafu.
I'm based in San Francisco, okay. But I'm from Canada. I go back a lot. And so I kind of feel like I've been practicing down here, obviously for over 20 years, but still have a good idea what goes on back home in Canada. So I'm both. I'm a dual citizen.
Okay, well, I thank you for correcting me. So, but what I was trying to get at was American medicine focuses a lot of times less on the care and more about the fix. And so I appreciate that not only do you have an inclusive lens of trans folks, but also that the human is first. It's not their, you know, their medical needs. That's part of it. But it's a human-centered approach to vaginal health and health of genitalia, just kind of across the board. So yeah, anyways, that was a tangent, just to kind of getting up on my soapbox about, you know, the United States and how fucked we are sometimes.
Yeah, well, I've spent 30 years listening to women. You know, there are kind of, I would say, like the unspoken words, you know what those are, because you start to read the same facial expression or you hear the same sort of social circumstance that led up to this. And so I really felt it was important to sort of include the societal pressures, you know, all the different ways that women might come to have this problem, or someone with a vagina might come to have a specific problem that led to the doctor's office. And just to be able to sort of, you know, also say that, you know, the only wrong is to not be informed in your choice. Right. So I'm a firm believer in your body, your choice, but it breaks my heart when people make choices from places of misinformation and they were, you know, willfully misinformed by someone online. And so, you know, I want people to be empowered so they can make decisions.
You have such a great chapter on media literacy too. There is a chapter about Dr. Google, and I am absolutely, that is the first thing I do. I have any like suggestion of a symptom of any kind, like I am on Google and I have cancer. Like that is always
exactly.
I go.
So I think it's super important. So a lot of times, you know, what a really common question I get is, well, don't you hate when people look things up online? And my answer is no, I think it's great. The internet is a library and people should use it, but we should teach people how to use it. Otherwise, you know, people aren't using it correctly. And so, you know, that's why I said included, I know everybody looks things up and that's okay. And when people say, ooh, I looked it up, I'm like, great, that's fine. But what I'd like you to do is like, I'd like you to go to a professional society's, you know, webpage and search in there, because you're not going to get ads. You're not going to get, you know, bias. You're going to get, you know, if there was bias, it's disclosed, and then work backwards from there. You know, start with the most accurate source of information and then go backwards. And it, you know, amazes me how many people, you know, doctors included, just go to Google. I'm like, you know, there's a better way to search. I always, every single topic I look up, I always start in a professional society's site and then go from there.
Interesting. What other tips do you have to kind of weed out misinformation then?
Don't get information from a site selling you the product that they're giving you information about. Absolutely never close the browser. You don't want to be contaminated. It's very easy just for a headline to stick in your head. So never get information from someone who recommends homeopathy, because that's magic. Never get information from somebody who believes in medical conspiracy theories. So if they're anti-vaccine or anti-fluoride, they do not have your best interests at heart. And so it's always harder to say what's great information, because science does change, but it's very easy to say what's bad and terrible information. And for example, there was a study that shows that doctors who recommend homeopathy are less likely to adhere to other standards of care and testing, right?
Interesting.
So, yeah. Well, you know, if you practice one form of magic, you probably believe in others.
Yeah. Why do you think there's such a distrust of science and doctors and medicine right now?
Well, I think we are suffering globally from a distrust of science. I mean, there are people who don't accept the science of climate change. There are people who don't accept the science of vaccine safety. And so I think that we have a literacy problem. I think in medicine, traditionally, doctors have been really bad communicators. It's been very patriarchal. How to communicate with patients is really a relatively recent thing. I mean, I was taught it in the 80s, but you know, that's pretty recent if you think about it, and probably wasn't as well taught as it could be. And then I think that we haven't had a broad range of voices in medicine. I mean, when I trained, it was all white men. I never met a female chief of a medical department until 15 years ago. Mm. You know, so I think that if you exclude so many voices from the conversation, you have such a narrow conversation.
Yes. But I feel like what I see online, especially the anti-vaxxers and the Goop lovers, are the, you know, upper middle class, upper class white women who are most likely to also follow patriarchal standards.
Right. I think that unfortunately that there's sort of this misuse of privilege, and that you are so privileged to never have been exposed to polio, and you are so privileged to not have, you know, suffered the overcrowding that maybe makes measles transmission more common. You are so privileged to lead this life, and this is what you choose to do with that privilege. I find it really fascinating. And actually, it's a faux feminism, I think. Mm-hmm. That's the best way to describe it. So if you look at sites like Goop, which they claim that they're empowering women, they're actually doing the opposite. They're spreading misinformation. And misinformation is the opposite of feminism, right? Telling people less about their bodies is harmful. It's making them follow patriarchal myths. I mean, and so for saying things like, you know, vagina steaming, you know, that's based in the idea that you had to clean the uterus of toxins, which is one of the first patriarchal constructs, that women are dirty and there's something wrong with the biology, right? So you are actually absorbing that toxic masculinity, that toxic patriarchy, and you're repackaging it for profit. You are using the same fears that have been generationally instilled into women, like there's something wrong with your body, and you're rebranding that as feminism and profiting from it. I mean, that's an obscenity to me.
Mm-hmm. I did my master's thesis on the idea of post-feminism, which is, I think it's the same thing we're talking about, is feminism repackaged and sold to be choice feminism. And just because you have choices doesn't necessarily make them all feminist choices. Right. So I think that we're speaking about the same things here.
Yeah. I mean, an uninformed choice is the exact opposite of feminism. So yeah, it's fascinating to me. And I think it's in many ways cult-like, because, you know, just like you can't, you know, sway someone who's a hardcore anti-vaxxer with science and facts, you can't sway someone who, you know, believes that their yoni has energy that can be recharged with a jade egg. I mean, you know, it's true.
I know. I have some crystals and I don't necessarily think they have any, I think they're beautiful and they remind me to think about like abundance and prosperity and things like that. I don't think that they're going to make me rich. I certainly am not going to stick one up any orifice.
Right.
So that's just one that I find so bananas. What are some of the most common or the most insidious myths about women or women presenting bodies that you've encountered?
So I think that the vagina is dirty and needs douching or needs cleaning in some way. And we see that coming up in a lot of different ways. So we see it in, you know, douches, which are still sold. We see it in this idea that women need to use, you know, wipes on their external genitalia. I'm like, why are vulvas dirty but scrotums aren't? I don't get that. Why do people only care about women's rectums and not the rectums of men? Do men not have dirty rectums? I don't know. I seem to think that they might soil themselves rectally in the same way women do. I don't understand this. So we see all these products pushed on women. And then we see it also though in other ways. Like there was a online challenge a year ago or so, like the underwear challenge, where all these young women were bragging that they had no discharge on their underwear. And I'm like, well, that'd be like bragging you have no spit in your mouth and it's mucosa. It's supposed to be moist. And who wants dry eyes, dry mouth, dry nose, and dry vagina? Like not me. I want a moist vagina. That's where it's at. So yeah, so we see that sort of toxic myth kind of coming up in different ways. So I think that's the most pervasive one. And it's kind of like whack-a-mole. It just, you know, douches, wipes, underwear challenges, cleansing, you know, those stupid bags of herbs that people put in their vagina. Yeah. The latest one I heard about is colloidal silver vaginally. Dear God, don't do that.
Yikes. Yikes. Yeah. I'm so glad you're using the word moist. Another one of my soapboxes is I think that this kind of cute hatred of the word moist is actually anti-feminist because it's often associated with a vagina and therefore it's gross. But I mean, I like a moist cake. So what's wrong with that word?
Baby, moist is where it's at. That's all I got to say.
Yes.
That's why I'm on estrogen.
And I'm glad you said that. This is a book for women across the life cycle too.
Right. Absolutely. You know, if you're 12 or you're 82, you know, there is information about incontinence, menopause, sex, how to have good sex, how to recognize if you're having bad sex, how to talk, you know, maybe talk to your partner a little bit. I mean, it's not in depth about that. It's more of a technical manual, but you know, the misinformation that you might see about different things. And so it's really about, you know, everything across the board.
I appreciate that. So one of the things, you've been called Twitter's resident OBGYN.
Yeah.
How did you get there?
Actually, I think that came from The Cut. I believe it or not, I think they use that. And I guess I've just been one of the early adopters of Twitter and on social media, and I do like it. And I think it's a great way to pass information along. And then somewhere along the way, I got this, you know, just, I guess, larger following, and people were listening, and I just felt an ethical responsibility to do it correctly. You know, I never sell products. I'm just really here for the facts and kind of committed to doing it in an ethical way. The only thing I'm hoping people do is watch my show, because that's how you get more funding to do another show. And maybe buy my book. That would be great too.
Talk to me about your show.
Yeah, so it's called Gensplaining, and it's 10 episodes that's going to be available in Canada on CBC Gem, which is their digital platform for the CBC. And hopefully someone's going to pick it up in the States. It's being shopped around. And they're each 12-minute episodes, so very short, because otherwise people zone out. You know, you can't blab on about a subject. And basically, each episode follows the arc of me being annoyed about something online, and maybe the history of how we got to here, that, you know, maybe what we're thinking now isn't actually so different from 1,000 years ago. And then me talking to an expert and debunking the myths, and a little show and tell. I built a 3D model of the clitoris in one episode. And you could do that at home too if you had all the crafts. It's cheap crafting. I love crafting. And then a summary. So that's it. 12 minutes of that. Me being me.
I love it. And I can't wait. I hope that it gets picked up in the States, because I think that sounds right up my alley. I want to talk a little bit about the clitoris, because we don't talk about it enough.
And exactly.
I recently learned, I was listening to a podcast, which is something I say quite a bit. I think it was Call Your Girlfriend, possibly. But the clitoris was only really in its full form discovered in the last 10 years. Is that correct?
I think that's kind of one of those yes and no.
Okay.
Things. So, because I still have some of my anatomy textbooks from when I went to medical school. And, you know, one of my textbooks that was published in 1985 has a correct diagram with all the parts. And in fact, you know, as I explain in the book, I mean, there were doctors in the 1800s who had beautiful anatomic descriptions of the clitoris. So I think anatomically we knew all the parts were there. Whether that was discussed is a different subject, but it was definitely there. I mean, I also have a textbook from 1984 that had not a great picture of the clitoris, and they called it a mini penis. I'm like,
mm-hmm. Exactly. Oh, yeah.
Like, I don't think so. So whether it was talked about, but also you have to understand that the way we learn about body parts is by dissecting dead bodies. And, you know, almost all dead bodies that we dissect are elderly people. So, you know, if the 7 clitorises that were looked in an anatomic study were from women over the age of 80, they would also appear smaller, right? And less, you know, wouldn't be the same. So it wasn't until we got MRIs that we were really able to understand blood flow and engorgement and those kinds of things. So I think it's fair to say that, you know, anatomically, probably some of the information was repressed and wasn't taught, although we knew about it certainly in the 80s. But we couldn't have known the full sort of biology and physiology until an MRI scanner existed. We couldn't have had that information, because it's not like you can take a woman who's being sexually aroused and like cut her open and put probes in. Right. You know, with a man, you can put a probe around the penis and measure blood flow and engorgement. And so we didn't have that way, but with an MRI, we do. And, you know, those studies are expensive and hard to get, but, you know, now we have studies where people have sex in an MRI scanner, mm-hmm. and we actually see like what's getting pushed on what. So I think that's awesome. So I still think we're learning more, and that's great.
I'm going to leave a link in the show notes to my friend, August McLaughlin. She's a previous guest. She was a part of a study that was either an MRI or a CAT scan. I can't remember, but she masturbated to orgasm, and they took pictures of her brain, and that must have been a CAT scan then.
No, it would have been an MRI. It would have been an MRI.
Okay. Thank you.
Yeah.
Clearly I was a liberal arts major. So I'll leave a link to that. It's fascinating. She talks about it on her podcast, Girl Boner. It is so interesting.
Yeah. I mean, those are like awesome, cool studies. Yeah. But again, before like 1995, we couldn't have had that data. So, you know, so you can't really blame people in the 1970s for not having MRI data. I mean, I'm just, you know, not like I'm making an excuse for medicine, but more kind of like putting it in perspective.
Sure. And what else don't we know? You know, in 15 years, what are we going to learn about women's bodies and arousal and gender and sex in the next 15, 20, 25 years?
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's interesting. A lot of what we sort of think about, you know, how the brain responds is based on functional MRI studies. And, you know, whether those are as accurate as we think they are, I don't know. I'm certainly not a functional MRI expert, but I do know that someone once was doing a functional MRI study and they needed a control, like something dead with no brain activity. And so they bought like a dead fish and they put it in the scanner and it had activity. You know, I think that we have to sort of look at functional MRI scanners with just, you know, like it's possible. This is the best knowledge we have right now. It is entirely possible in 20 years' time. I don't think we're going to discover hidden body parts. I think we know everything that's there.
Sure.
But we may discover in 15 years that is a way better tool to answer these questions. Yeah. So I'm open to that. And that's what a scientist is. You're always open to, you know, new good data that comes along. Great. I know more now. Let's go from there.
And your book is a tool for that, is learning more about the body, the self, as it stands right now. This is all the most current information about your body and how to take care of it and how to best nurture it. So it's a good snapshot. It's an excellent snapshot. I really enjoyed this book and it's very readable. And I think your writing style is very approachable as well. It's not a medical journal. Can you talk about your writing style in it?
Well, you know, when I first started writing, you know, maybe about 8 or 10 years ago, I wrote as I thought people wanted doctors to write, and that was super boring. And then I thought, you know, my patients always tell me I explain things really well in the office, I explain things differently than other doctors. And I thought, why don't I just like write like I talk? Because that seems to be the effective communication style for me. So basically, yeah, I mean, everything I read, I've probably said out loud, and that's kind of how I work through a lot of stuff. I run. And so I'll often work through paragraphs while I'm running. And I'm sure people think I'm not well as I'm muttering to myself as I'm running. I think it's a conversational style, and I'm glad to hear that resonates with people.
Yeah, I think that's such a feminist thing to do, is to bring knowledge to, you know, lay people and not couch it in academic language. As a former academic, that was something that I was absolutely guilty of and encouraged to do. And so it's so nice to see scientists writing in a way that's so accessible.
And who encouraged you to do that? The patriarchy, right? You know?
Yeah, academia is the patriarchy.
Yeah. I mean, I think about, you know, all the articles I read for this. I mean, my house, I still haven't filed them all away. And those are the ones I printed. I mean, there's a lot I didn't, because trees. And the number that I almost fell asleep reading, like they had good information in them, but oh my gosh, like the way the method section was written, I was like, my head hurts. Yeah. And, you know, so I think that this idea that even academic writing should be like that, obviously, if nobody can understand it or it's so boring, you need to change it a little bit. So yeah.
What's the point?
Yeah. I mean, I think this idea of sort of being inaccessible because you're so smart is again, such a patriarchal construct, because they're the ones who benefit from excluding, you know, half of society.
Absolutely. It's elitist and really unfortunate, because there is so much knowledge out there that is just not for the people. And what's the point then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, this is, you know, this isn't like theoretical physics that, you know, three people need to be locked in a room, you know, mentally masturbating over, like, you know, this is real life that everybody deserves to have the information about in an accessible way that speaks to them.
Everybody has a body. Let's learn how to take care of it.
Exactly. Exactly. And knowing the forces behind the information that you're getting, which is sort of like equally important, right? Like, why does someone want you to know that piece of information? Or the thing that I really learned or started to really take seriously or more seriously when I was writing was, how does every single sort of fact that I thought I knew in medicine, I would say, okay, how does this serve the patriarchy versus how does this serve women? And it was really surprising to me when I used that eye towards everything, like how it made me think about things really differently. So it's interesting thought process or exercise to go through. And unfortunately, it's a red pill. Once you start doing it, then that's all you can see everywhere.
I'm sure. So we are giving away, if you're interested in reading, you know, medicine through a feminist lens, which so here for. We are giving away a copy of the Vagina Bible. So there will be a link in the show notes to enter to win that. If you have, we always ask our guests, if you have a book to recommend that's not your own, what would that be?
If we're staying on the sex education accurate information, I would say Better Sex Through Mindfulness. Ooh. By Dr. Lori Brado. So she is a PhD sex researcher in Canada. She was a guest on my show, Gensplaining, and I know her quite well. And, there's so much false information out there about women's libidos. You know, we are sold this idea that if you're not horny, there's something wrong with you. Horny is spontaneous libido, but many, many, many women and many men have receptive libido. And so these drugs that are sold to women for low libido basically are not well supported if you're looking at sort of the science of what libido really is. And she's been very involved in that research. And for many, many women who have libido issues, mindfulness is a very, very, very effective tool. As we know, our brain is the biggest sexual organ. So it's a fantastic book. I recommend it to everybody struggling with libido issues or just wants to know more about their own libido. And she'd be a great guest for you in the future, Better Sex Through Mindfulness, Dr. Lori Brado.
Wonderful. I'll leave a link to that in the show notes. I will be ordering a copy. That sounds excellent. Right up my alley. So where can we find you, especially on Twitter? Where can we find you online if we want to learn more or connect further?
Yeah, I'm Dr. Jen Gunter on all platforms. It's just easier that way. So I'm Dr. Jen Gunter on Twitter, on Facebook, on Instagram. I'm probably that on LinkedIn, but I don't actually really know what LinkedIn is, so I don't really use it. I always get these things. People are looking at your profile. I'm like, great. I don't know what to do with that. So that's where people can find me. And they can find me on CBC Gem with Gensplaining, and they can find me in bookstores near you.
Yeah. Excellent. Definitely go pick up a copy of this book. It is just one of those books to have on your shelf to refer to whenever you've got a question and maybe you can't get into the doctor quite yet. So it's your first step. I think it's fantastic. It's a great reference and really easy and enjoyable to read. So thank you for writing it. Thank you for being here. And this has been an absolute honor to chat with you today.
Oh, thanks so much. This was so much fun. Thanks again. And thanks for doing this. I think this is such a great podcast and so needed for everybody.
Thank you so much. That's very kind. Thanks for listening to today's show. As always, a rating and review in the podcast app of your choice goes a long way in supporting feminist media. We'd love to have you join the Feminist Book Club subscription box, a community-driven subscription box which features a book of the month and products from women and queer-owned businesses delivered directly to your doorstep. This is an easy way to vote with your dollars, as you'll be supporting this podcast, small women and queer-owned businesses, and the charity beneficiary of the month, which receives 5% of total sales. Use code PODCAST for a discount on any subscription package. Learn more about the box and get the show notes for today's episode at feministbookclub.com. See you next time.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh. A well-